This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You are listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Welcome, everyone, to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation,
which it almost wasn't this week. In full disclosure,
teetering on the edge here. We're putting our producer Todd Weber, the manager, in a very tight bind because you see, a little something happened over the last week and a half or so, 2 weeks, called Christmas. And then New Year's, and well, it's been a long, strange journey for us, Nick, and we've been through the trials and tribulations to get here to this late recording of our show right here in Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza.
Yes, pushing through illnesses and various just logistical challenges, and yet here we are to do the best we can, or actually. Not at all the best we can hear tonight.
Not at all. This is a phoning it in, keeping the streak alive edition. Second in a row, in fact, of the hard-traveling fanboys. Mm-hmm. I am Greg Phillips, of course, and that voice you hear on the other end of the line is none other than the oats to my Hall, the Hall to my Nash, the Nash to my Crosby, Stills, and Young. Mm-hmm. None other than Nick Duke.
Yes, that's me.
It's he, Nick Duke. Now, one of the other things that happened over the last few weeks, Nick, that we have yet to discuss on the show is
I can't even sniff right now. So, good thing you won.
Yes, little thing called the Fantasy Football Championship, Nick. Would you care to update the people on the final standings in our league?
No.
I will then.
Okay.
So it came down to, as mentioned on the show, a colossal showdown between the Hilton Hulkamaniacs and the Prestige. And after a grueling season of ups and downs, I'm happy to report that my team, the Prestige, vanquished Nick Duke's favorite Hilton Hulkamaniacs, putting an end to their dominant regular season and taking home the Foosball Championship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nick, it was a good season, and you played a hell of a game. We're humble in victory, as always, at the Prestige Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have to say, do you have any comments to the media about what happened in that game?
No.
Fair enough. We'll have to see where it leads next year, but I got to say, the smell of victory is addictive, and I gotta say, I'm gonna come back, and I'm gonna make it a repeat next year.
No.
Very good. Now, what are we here to discuss? We're here to do Hard Travelers for Hire. This is, of course, our usually monthly look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, one movie at a time. We started all the way back at Iron Man and have worked our way up through the beginning of 2018. Our last venture into the series was a look at Black Panther. So that brings us now, finally, to the arrival of Thanos, which was promised all the way back in Avengers, the first one, and comes to fruition in this movie, Avengers Infinity War. Nick, this is a big one, and you would think, if you were a longtime listener of the show, that this would be an extravagant episode with guests and lots of in-depth discussion. You would think that, and you would be wrong.
Yes, you would. Indeed, you would. We are not prepared for that here tonight, and we make no apologies for it.
No. Anyone who would like to complain to us, as always, is welcome to tweet us at JRSBBQ.
BBQ. That's right. That's the place to find us, and you know we're gonna just gonna push forward.
So, in Avengers Infinity War, what hasn't been written about this movie at this point? The fan theories, the critical reception, the audience reception, the think pieces. My God, the think pieces, Nick. This movie has been written about at this point into the ground, and we're just going to add a little bit on top of that with some of our patented hard-traveling humor.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, though.
Hard-hitting analysis.
Hard-hitting analysis.
Hot takes.
This movie was made on a budget of somewhere between $316 and $400 million, according to Wikipedia.
Give or take $10
million. Yeah. And the box office take currently sits at $2.049 billion.
Mm.
So a very successful film, to say the least. A cast of dozens, maybe hundreds, really, when you take in the extras.
Yep.
Of The Rock's fans. This was a... Like we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this is kind of the payoff to a long, festering, a long-building subplot in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But, as you all know, the way that this works is we put the movie on. In this case, it's streaming now on Netflix. So we put the movie on in the background. We're not going to watch the entire movie. It's 2.5 hours long. That's far too long for us to talk. But we're going to put it on to kind of spark our discussion or remind us of things that we need to address. So we have it paused right now at the 0 minute and 0 second mark. We're going to give you time to go get your movie fired up. Pause the show now if you want to. Go get your movie fired up and then join us because we are going to hit play in 3, 2, 1, play. And watching this in stunning high definition on Netflix, I have to say it's pretty cool and pretty convenient, Nick.
I'm watching it on my iPad, not my iPad Pro, unfortunately, just a standard iPad. We peasants can't aspire to have, you know, possessions as fine and as luxurious as the manager, Todd Weber.
That's right. I am currently watching on my old Vizio 37-inch TV, and it's, I have recently purchased a new TV, but I have not had a chance to set it up yet, so... That will be coming this weekend, hopefully. But the picture is clear. The sound is good. It's a great really poppin' motion picture, Nick.
It is. And already, you know, as I'm sure will happen throughout this broadcast, I'm being caught in by just watching the movie.
Yes, we are. Our opening here, as you see on the screen for those watching along, is in the depths of space, and we are introduced to a brand new character right out of the gate, and he is the Ebony Maw.
Go ahead.
And the Ebony Maw appears as basically the Paul Heyman to Thanos' Brock Lesnar. Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's a very apt comparison, although he does present a bit more of a physical threat than Paul Heyman does, but he is very much the hype man, the Bundini Brown, if you will.
Yes, and much like Paul Heyman, he finds increasingly elaborate and almost hyperbolic language to use to describe Thanos to those who approach him.
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is the Ebony Maw. It's pretty much what he says at
Go
the
on.
Beginning of everything. I come to you as a humble representative and servant of a man who dominates the galaxy. Not a single being in this entire universe has the might, nay, the nobility of Thanos, and so forth.
There you go.
And we're picking up really on the heels of Thor Ragnarok, Nick, as... The leftovers of Asgard are just being decimated by Thanos and his forces. Loki has been captured. Thor has been pummeled and rendered useless at the hands of Thanos.
Mm-hmm. This is made up from the post-credit scene from Thor Ragnarok that implied that this was coming.
Mm-hmm. The ship is just in tatters. Thor is bleeding. He's already eyeless, of course. Well, one eyeless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this sets up really right out of the gate the threat level of Thanos. Because I thought this was a very important way to start the movie, Nick. You have to, if Thanos is going to be your villain, you need to establish that he's not like anyone we've seen before.
Right.
He's not a sit on his ass and do nothing schemer. He's not a mild physical threat that can be overcome by the Hulk or Thor, who are the two most powerful Avengers by far. Right out of the gates, we're establishing that Thanos, even with just, at this point, just one of the Infinity Stones, right?
Yeah, it's one.
At this point, even with just one of the stones, Thanos is far too powerful for any of the Avengers to take on one-on-one. As he is, he's already beaten Thor. Loki's treachery from the end of Ragnarok is revealed here. But again, he's trying to save Thor's life here. So it is continuing the shades of gray, but he's not as bad as we used to think he was version of Loki. Particularly Marvel recently revealed, Nick, I guess you saw that Loki was mind controlled in the original Avengers movie by Thanos.
Mm-hmm. I did see that. Which is kind of weird because it wasn't really implied at any point, I didn't feel like. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't really like that retcon, honestly.
It is what it is. And now Thanos, after being attacked by Hulk, Loki gets to deliver the classic line from Avengers, "We have a Hulk."
Mm-hmm.
And now that Hulk is getting the shit kicked at him. So,
yes.
Point being,
this is awesome.
Rather than narrate this scene to you as I'm doing so far, I want to. Do you agree with me, Nick, that this was important to establish that Thanos is next level?
Yeah, I would agree. It kind of feels similar. I mean, like a much more ramped up version of the opening of Star Wars: A New Hope to me, where you have the boarding of the ship and like you mm-hmm. get to see the primary physical threat kind of, you know, whoop some ass here in the opening scene. Granted, brought up to 2018 standards rather than 1977 with in terms of the physicality of Thanos as compared to Vader or whatever. But, yeah, it's a cool opening. I know some people have said they would have preferred to have seen the movie actually open on Xandar, where it would actually like to have seen Thanos get the Power Stone, because that kind of happens off-screen. It's just kind of alluded to. But, you know, I kind of... Not having seen what that alternate beginning may have looked like, kind of hard to complain too much about what we got.
Right, yeah. It's like joining in media res. We're already in the middle of this conflict, and it's already looking bad. It's already looking like the end of days, so to speak. Which, you know, kind of think of it, Nick, that would have been a hell of a crossover here. Now, what's to stop Arnold's character from End of Days mm-hmm. from interacting with Thanos? Maybe he has the key to undoing everything that happens in this movie.
Thanos is a choir boy, a fucking choir boy compared to him.
A fucking choir boy compared to me! Mm-hmm. A choir boy!
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Arnold, you know, that takes some balls to say that to the literal devil.
Yeah. Yeah. If only Batman had said that to Dr. Hurt back then.
Dr. Simon Hurt.
Yep.
You know, Nick, we'll have to revisit that at a later time, the concept of Dr. Simon Hurt.
Oh, God, no. In any event, moving forward, what is this? What is he doing?
He's crushing the Tesseract into the Space Stone?
Yeah, I think the implication is that the Space Stone was inside the Tesseract, much like the,
yes.
If you remember, the Mind Stone was inside Loki's scepter, the mm-hmm. Power Stone was inside the orb. It seems like they're all inside something else.
Hmm. Interesting. Maybe one of them can be found inside Amy Schumer.
Well, you'd have to ask Dolph Ziggler about that.
Oh! I'd rather ask Dolph Lundgren about it, but he probably wouldn't know.
He probably, no, he would only know about Bridget Nielsen.
Yes. the somewhat haggard Brigitte Nielsen.
Haggard, what an excellent term.
Oh, I love this bit with Loki, man. Like if Loki's gonna go out, I told you about this in Ragnarok. I buy in every time to his redemption stories that don't end up being redemption stories. But man, if this really was the end of Loki, I love the fact that he went out like a G trying to take Thanos out and almost gets there. Comes moderately close to almost getting there.
Comes moderately close to almost getting there. I guess that's a accomplishment of some sort. Sadly, like now after the fact, and you can't apply this retroactive knowledge to the film, but we know it's not going to be the last of Loki, as they've confirmed that Loki television series that apparently is not going to be a prequel. So,
oh really?
Yep.
I did not know it was not going to be a prequel.
Nope. That's the report, is that it will not be a prequel. So Loki will be, we'll see Loki again one day in some shape, form, or fashion. Which he's the one character you can kind of buy fake deaths, although you would think that Thanos here would not have fallen for such a ploy. But
especially since Thanos explicitly says no resurrections this time.
Yeah.
That would seem, but if there's one thing if there's one flaw I would point out about the MCU to this point, it's that there has been a distinct lack of commitment to Satan character deaths.
You know, that's probably true, but I think you're alluding mainly to Coulson at this point. And to their credit, the movies haven't really acknowledged that at all, you know?
That's true.
It's almost like it's just this thing that they don't really care that the TV show did, you know?
Yes, a thing that should have never happened.
Well,
quite frankly.
To each their own on that, whoever it is that may be defending the Coulson resurrection. I'm sure there are those out there who prefer
it. There are those, I'm sure.
All right, here's a fun game. Can you name the members of the Black Order?
The Ebony Maw.
Yes, you got that one. No Googling.
Sickle cell anemia. And I don't know, Liberia?
The female is Proxima Midnight.
Yes, Proxima Midnight.
The Skrull-looking one is Corvus Glaive, and I do not know the name of the large one.
Corvus Glaive sounds like a line that would be delivered by Professor Frink on The Simpsons. Glaiven! Corvus Glaiven!
I don't know, man.
Anyway.
Let's see here. Black Order MCU. Cole Obsidian is the other one's name.
That's kind of a cool name.
Yeah, Cole Obsidian. That's a pretty cool name.
Well, I mean, the only purpose for all of them, except so the Ebony Maw's purpose is to be awesome and kiss the ass of Thanos. Mm-hmm. The rest of them, their only purpose is there to be physical foes. The only minor character development they get is that one of them dies, and what did you say the woman's name was?
Proxima Midnight.
Proxima Midnight has a vendetta against Black Widow and
Yeah, but Corvus Glaive doesn't actually die. They don't even kill him because then he pops up later near the end at the Wakanda scene.
Well, then which one is it that dies? Because doesn't one of them, she says he'll pay for his life with yours.
I don't remember, man.
Anyway, they're just there to be thugs, basically. They're like Joker's henchmen, like Bob the Goon.
Mm-hmm. But a little bit more physically imposing than Bob the Goon, granted.
Bob the Goon was physically imposing, come on.
Bob the Goon was not physically imposing, sir.
He was!
No. I like Bob as much as the next guy, but, you know.
You're being a little disrespectful right now.
Here's Tony with the classic tie the jacket around the neck look that, you know.
Chris Jericho used that to great success in recent years.
He did. He did.
Or is that a scarf?
I'm not really sure what that is. It's certainly a unique look, and then there we go. There's the new Iron Man thing, the arc reactor he's attached to his body since Iron Man 3.
Yes, now he uses nanites for a pretty cool, actually a pretty cool new way to apply the Iron Man suit.
Oh yeah,
I really enjoyed this new suit that he uses here, where he can assemble it in bit pieces if he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be throwing out the idea here of having children with Pepper, an idea of Iron Man as a father. Now, do you think that these thoughts are coming to him as a result of his interactions with one Peter Parker in Spider-Man Homecoming?
That's certainly a good way to look at it. Hopefully showing that both of them learned something from that experience. And here comes and there's your favorite character. We saw him earlier that we didn't really reference him, but here he is interacting with Tony Stark. Dr. Strange.
Mr. Strange.
He did not go to medical school to be called Mr. Thank you.
Very good. And you notice on Dr. Strange, he's got the white temples here, which is cool.
Yep.
So I'm going to go ahead and say this out of the gate. There's so much to talk about here. There's so many characters to talk about. Doctor Strange in Infinity War, gigantic greater than sign, Doctor Strange in Doctor Strange.
Well, I think that's largely, due in part to the fact that he has other charismatic actors to bounce off of. Because, in Doctor Strange, everybody is playing it pretty straight. Like, you have Wong, who kind of has this really dry sense of humor, and you have the Ancient One, who is, playing it as straightly as she possibly can. And then you have Baron Mordo, who's kind of got this inner, anger and resentment kind of building up in throughout the film. But nobody in the film is really poking fun at anything, whereas Tony, that is the epitome of what he does, and so you kind of have it makes it a little bit more interesting for that character to have different types of characters to kind of butt heads with.
Yes, and here we're getting a fully fleshed out Doctor Strange. We're not getting the unsure, Tony, as I called him in our podcast, Tony Stark Light, that we got, in my opinion, in the movie Doctor Strange. Here we're getting a fully formed Doctor Strange that's acting much more like you would expect from his comics counterpart, and butting heads here with the only person maybe on planet Earth who has an ego as big as his, which is Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm. And here it is, Tony proposing just destroying the Time Stone to start with, and no one's doing it.
No one's doing it because Doctor Strange has sworn himself to the Ancient Order of protecting the Eye of Agamemnon.
Agamotto,
who gives a shit? All I know is if that stone gets destroyed, we're all toast.
Mm-hmm. Balloon animals.
Protecting your reality, douchebag. Yeah. So, what are your thoughts on that, Nick?
On what?
Doctor Strange is thoroughly committed to protecting this thing because that's what he's sworn his life to. But Tony proposes this idea that, on its surface, makes a hell of a lot of sense.
It really does. But on that note, why wouldn't everybody just destroy the Infinity Stones anytime they come across them? I don't know. It's one of those things that, you kind of can't think about too much, or else the movie, at the end of the day, it's a comic movie. Like, how much logic are we really looking for here? Now, granted, later on, the entire climax of this movie will revolve around them trying to destroy the Mind Stone, or which whatever fucking stone it is. I don't know. I can't keep them all straight. The yellow one that's in the Vision's head.
That's the Mind Stone.
We don't know what the fuck does the Mind Stone. Sure, whatever.
It's the Mind Stone. I told you. I told Harn 10 years ago. I said, the one thing you don't have is the Mind Stone.
So this is the Time Stone, obviously. We got that. And then he already has the Power Stone and the Space. Is the Tesseract the Space Stone? Is that what they say?
The Space Stone, yes. I believe that is.
And then the Vision has the Mind Stone. And then he gets the Soul Stone in the movie. So by the process of elimination, that means the Aether from Thor the Dark World must be the Reality Stone then.
Yes, that's the reality, the Reality Stone, which you can tell by the red color, I believe, of everything.
Okay, I guess.
Yes. It's kind of like when Kane comes out and the entire arena turns red,
Now, that's you mean to tell me he didn't have time for a 30-second phone call here as everything starts to shake?
No, apparently not, especially on that old phone still in service. Not that I'd know anything about that.
Yeah. There are only two people on the planet he can call, Steve Rogers and you.
And me, that's right, because mine still works, baby. I can hear just fine on it. Just fine. Doesn't do so good with video messages, though.
No, it does not.
So
at this point in the MCU, yeah. If I'm somebody who lives in New York, I'm probably just thinking about, like, why am I still here? You know, we should probably explore other places to live.
It's the same thing we talked about when we reviewed the Batman movies last summer. Why would anyone live in Gotham City?
No.
Ever.
You shouldn't. You should just leave. I mean, Star City, I tell you what, if I lived in Star City, I would just take a vacation every May. Because,
every day, the city's in danger.
The city is getting destroyed, or, like, there are earthquakes, or an army of supervillains, or something like that. So, May is the time to just hit the dusty trail, I think.
Yeah, you have to actually go out in the streets and help the hero by wishing the villain away. it's just not a good time. Just go and live in Keystone for a little while or something, you know, or take a vacation out into the French Alps, maybe. Meet you a giant.
This is good.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that I've talked about in our online chat group that we're in that no one else knows about I love this cameo from Stan Lee. Got to mention it. I absolutely love this. Haven't you kids ever seen a spaceship before? But one of the things that I've noticed is, you know, I was lower. I liked Spider-Man Homecoming, but I was lower on it than you were and lower on it than a lot of people are. But I come to realize while I just like Spider-Man Homecoming, I love Tom Holland's Spider-Man, and this is a great example of it right here. He's swinging right into danger, and that is so Peter Parker. He's not scared yet. He doesn't even has a chance to be scared yet. He swings right into the face of danger and doesn't know any better. He does such a good job of playing that youthful, energetic. I don't even know how to describe it, but that essence of the young Peter Parker, he does it so well here.
Absolutely. And here we are with the Ebony Maw making another Paul Heyman-esque speech.
Yes. Because if they don't get out of there soon and give them the time stone, then they will be beaten, conquered, and victimized by Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what he'll leave them in, Nick?
I don't.
He will leave them all in a pile of blood and sweat and vomit.
That's good. And here we are with the first sign of Hulk dysfunction, Hulk tile dysfunction on the part of Bruce Banner.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, how did you read this whole thing? Because my interpretation of the movie every time I watch it is that Hulk is embarrassed after getting his ass handed to him by Thanos.
I kind of took it that way too, because, like, if you're, it depends. Because on the one hand, you know, like the Thor stuff in this movie, I'm sure we'll discuss at some point, it seems like they're kind of trying to distance themselves from a little bit of, like, the character interpretations of Ragnarok. But if you're going to use the character interpretation of Ragnarok that they use for the Hulk in that movie as a kind of, like, you know, like 9-year-old, 10-year-old, like, kid. It kind of makes sense that now he is sulking because for the first time in his life, he's, you know, not the strongest, most badass thing that ever walked the planet. And he actually got humbled for once in his life. And so now, not so much that he's scared, it's just that he's pouting about it is kind of the way I take it.
Yep. It's like a bully that gets knocked out for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's hard for him to handle that psychologically. So he's pouting as you put it in the corner and won't come out and play.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first example that we see of Doctor Strange is just so much cooler here than he was in his own movie. He has some of the best moments through the course of this movie in terms of the action, the fight scenes. They really take advantage of his strange abilities.
Yes. Yeah, so you have, like, the portals and stuff that he opens, and then, like, later in the film when they're fighting Thanos on Titan, they have that cool moment where he makes all the duplicates and stuff. So, yeah, there's some really cool moments for him throughout this one. It makes it even more curious that we haven't really heard anything about a Doctor Strange sequel, which we would assume he's going to be one of the pillars of the MCU going forward, but still nothing on that front.
Bruce Banner beating himself and not in the fun way.
No. No, he is not. Boom.
So
there he is.
Yeah. Tony and Peter picking up their chemistry from Homecoming. I mean, Robert Downey Jr., we it's almost pointless to even talk about him because we'll say the same things we say about him in all these movies. He's, you know, great, awesome, delivers everything with panache, virtually steals every scene that he's in. You know, he's just the man. So there's, you know, no real point in harping on that. He's just awesome in this movie.
No, that was cool. On both sides, whether it was the bricks turning into darts or whatever, and then also Strange and Wong, like, making them disappear, that was, both sides were cool.
Mm-hmm. So while we're talking about Tony and Peter, let's go ahead and talk about that scene at the end of the movie, Nick, the death scene.
Jumping right there. All right.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point in going linearly because we're going to have to jump around anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So while we're talking about these two characters, that's kind of the big emotional beat in the movie. What did that scene do for you? What did you make of it? Did it work on you?
Oh, yeah, it absolutely worked. I mean, like, because if I remember correctly, it was also the last of the, quote, dusting deaths. So I had kind of, you know, I was already – I think it was smart to put it last because, like, they had you on this uneven footing of, like, shocking death after shocking death because I don't think any of us were expecting – or I don't think most of us anyway were expecting the new characters to be the ones that were going to get dusted away at the end of this or snapped away by Thanos. So they've kind of already got you – you know, leaning a little bit. They've got you emotionally engaged with all the other deaths you didn't expect, like Black Panther or whatever. And then, you know, to have Spider-Man go, who's a character I have an immense emotional attachment to anyway, but also the one that they had, you know, shown having the closest bond, honestly, to any of the original Avengers with his relationship with Iron Man, and having him die right there in Tony's arms, worked for me, man. Still works for me.
Yeah, me too.
That was cool.
The performance and the writing was so great. From just Mr. Stark, I don't feel so good.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony's emotional reaction to that, and how it's like he's watching his son die. You know, even though he doesn't have a son.
This is great. Peter climbing the spaceship.
Oh yeah, and I love that rocket boost for Iron Man too. That was tremendous. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that scene was awesome. Bruce Banner and the Hulk, we talked about their dynamic a little bit. I would say he's probably the least important, other than Hawkeye, who's missing, of the original Avengers in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get a lot. Maybe you could argue Black Widow, but Hulk doesn't get much to – or Bruce Banner doesn't get much to do in this except to kind of – occasionally deliver a few sciencey lines.
Mm-hmm.
But he's always good while he's there.
Oh, this is so cool.
As most of the cast are. They're so well matched to their characters. Characters. What were your thoughts on Banner in this one?
I think they kind of sidelined him intentionally, you know, because once you've done that Hulk and Thanos fight at the beginning, you can't really go back to it. You got to find something else to do, at least in this movie, because we're all assuming that, you know, we're going to see Hulk and Thanos fight again at some point, probably in Endgame. So if you're not going to do that fight again, you need a believable reason not to do it. So you have to work in this this kind of sidelining the Hulk angle. And so you have Banner as more of a scientist guy, which is good because we haven't really seen a lot of Banner. We primarily spent time in Ragnarok with Hulk, not Banner. And he's kind of been away from these other characters for a while, so that was a welcome return for me.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And he does get a chance to be in the Hulkbuster armor, which is kind of cool as well. And they make some good use of that. But he's kind of the forgotten one in this group, alongside, like I mentioned, Black Widow, who is fairly underutilized in this film, but does get a few moments here and there. This is kind of where we see our teams kind of split off. So Tony and Peter and Doctor Strange are in space, stuck with the Ebony Maw. Banner and there's Wong, and that's the last we'll see of him.
He's going off to do Sanctum Sanctorum things or something.
Yes, Rick Santorum things. And Banner and the Earthbound Avengers are going to get together. And meanwhile, here, we open up with the Guardians of the Galaxy, and they're going to encounter Thor in space, and that's going to be a separate – even they're going to separate. We're getting almost four separate paths here in just a little bit. But we talked about this at the time the movie came out, Nick, when we gave our thoughts on it on the show. James Gunn helped with the Guardians of the Galaxy segments of the movie, mm-hmm. and that really shows, because does this sequence not feel like it's right out of one of the Guardians movies?
Yeah, I think he actually got to pick the song, actually, even for this. So that all around, it's made some interesting an interesting incorporation, because I think we always kind of question what the Guardian, how the Guardians would fit into the more typically more serious context of an Avengers movie, but pretty seamless, mm-hmm. I have to say, pretty seamless for me anyway.
Agreed, very seamless, and I will go ahead and say I think this was the best use of Rocket yet in any of the movies. I liked Rocket in Guardians fine. He was all right. He was great in Guardians 2, but I love Rocket in this one. Just seeing him and how he handles Thor's situation later on in the movie, when Thor is kind of revealing a little bit of his vulnerability unexpectedly. I just love seeing the side of Rocket who's not angry all the time, because we've kind of grown accustomed to seeing Rocket be mad constantly. And in this movie, we get to see a little bit of a different side of Rocket, that he keeps that gruff exterior up, but he does have some level of empathy and caring underneath that. So that was fun to see. And then, of course, one of the stars of the movie is Zoe Saldana as Gamora. She gets more to do here, Nick. I don't know if you would agree, but I feel like she gets more to do here from a character standpoint than she even got in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, where she was really good.
Yeah, I would agree, because they're refocusing on her relationship with Thanos, which is something that was kind of touched on in the first Guardians and used as an explanation and a motivation for her character. But then even though she got a little bit more time in Guardians 2, they kind of moved away from that and then come back to it here in a big way, which makes sense.
Yes, and if you're talking about show-stealing performances, let's talk about our boy, Big Dave.
Here he is.
His role as Drax the Destroyer, getting some awesome lines. This is no man.
You're a dude. This is a man.
This is a man. Yeah. It's true. You have put on some weight. What are you talking about? And then just the pointing at his chin and the belly.
Yes. Yes.
Just awesome. This whole scene is amazing. It's funny. It's completely in keeping with the Guardians, and especially seeing the Thor that we saw in Ragnarok interact with the Guardians makes a lot of sense. And what we're about to see Star-Lord put on a fake voice to try to impress everybody else in the presence of Thor. It doesn't get a lot better than this, guys. This is one of my favorite parts of the movie, and I could watch an entire Thor and the Guardians of the Galaxy movie after this one.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Makes you wonder if there might not be a future for those two concepts kind of mashed up, especially after Chris Hemsworth has said he's interested in, you know, doing more Thor, when at first it was thought that he might not after Avengers Endgame, mm-hmm. and the uncertainty of the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise right now, given no director or writer for that film. Let's see. We'll have to wait and see how it all plays out. But yeah, good pairing here.
Of the Guardians in this movie, obviously Gamora gets the most story here. Her and Thanos play a huge role in this and have one of the strongest emotional plots in the subplots in the movie. Drax gets some great lines when he's eating and believes himself to be invisible. Is probably his best line in the movie. I don't know. He's had a lot of good ones here in a very short period of time. And then, of course, Rocket gets a lot to do going on a quest with Thor. The two that don't really get much to do at all are Mantis and Groot. They're kind of largely background fodder in this movie.
Yeah, Groot is here to make the angsty teenager joke, and that's pretty much it.
And Mantis really does nothing of note that I can think of.
No, but she is key to that almost succeeds in taking down Thanos at the end. Yeah.
Yes, that they do a really good job of cleverly using her power to temporarily subdue Thanos, which is neat. And it gives her a little bit more agency going forward, I think. This is where they kind of diverge. Rocket and Groot go with Thor on a quest, on really a traditional hero's quest to find this mystical object that can help him defeat the bad guy. And that's why I've made the argument a few times that in a lot of ways it was like a Thor movie. Like it's his story.
His part of it, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he's on this hero's journey, and he gets the big moment at the end, which we'll talk about in a little bit. He gets the big hero's moment at the end of the movie, or at least almost gets it. The other subplot here, of course, is the Guardians going to find Thanos, which would be Star-Lord, Gamora, Drax, and Mantis going off to try and find and confront Thanos. All we've seen of Thanos to this point is that opening where he's kind of physically dismantling everyone. We haven't yet gotten into the depth and nuance that we get on Thanos in this movie. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about Josh Brolin, who is playing Thanos. You know, we've talked in the last few Hard Travelers for Hires about the MCU's villain problem kind of being overstated at this point. There is no villain problem anymore.
Nope.
The last several Marvel movies have had excellent villains, in fact. And Thanos is right in step with those. Thanos continues the recent Marvel trend of three-dimensional villains, the exact opposite of, you know, whatever that villain's name was in Ant-Man, Yellow Jacket.
Yellow Jacket, yes.
Is that right? Thanos here, unlike his comic counterpart, who is motivated in the original Infinity Gauntlet storyline by a love of death, literally a love of the personification of death, this is a Thanos who is motivated by restoring the scales of balance to the universe. He believes that the perils of overpopulation and overexpansion are going to end up destroying the universe and have thrown things out of whack. He's predicted this on his own planet and watched it get destroyed because no one would listen to him, almost positioning him as a Jor-El type figure, right? That had this prediction of destruction that was ignored, and now he's going to go about making sure that it doesn't happen to the rest of the universe. What are your thoughts on this version of Thanos compared to the version that we read when we reviewed the Infinity Gauntlet all the way back in May?
Yeah, you know, I like it. I'm not – but I think part of that is because I didn't read Infinity Gauntlet until I was I was 19, I think, when I read it for the first time. So did not grow up with a certain interpretation of Thanos. Have no real attachment to the obsessed, in love with death version of the character, because really the only story I've read the character in is Infinity Gauntlet. He's popped up here and there in other Marvel events or Marvel comics, but never really been the focus of anything I've read, you know, since then, even though I know he's been featured in numerous stories since. So I'm down for this. I'm down for this change, even if I do think there's some validity to the argument, well, if he has the Infinity Gauntlet, why doesn't he just double all the resources and there you go, instead of killing everybody. But again, can't nitpick too much with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it feels like that opens up a world of, you know, because comics type situations. Like, you know, it's kind of difficult to envision. I mean, the comic book motivation for Thanos, I think, would be very difficult to do on the big screen. Granted, they could use Hela in that role as the personification of death. So I suppose they could do it that way. But I find this version in some ways more interesting because it gives him depth. It makes him not a quote-unquote evil villain. It makes him a villain because he is good. He has noble purposes, and he's going about them the wrong way and doesn't realize it. He thinks that he's doing something selfless that will save and preserve the universe when in fact he's not. And it does tie into that concept that we've read about in the comics, that Thanos thinks that he knows how to use the Infinity Gauntlet properly and actually does not.
Right.
And is probably going to end up being his undoing. Because you're right, why not just increase the resources? And there you have it. But ultimately, that's the MacGuffin of Marvel Comics. So with that, this is almost an ecologically minded Thanos, which is not unprecedented in the comics, as he's going about trying to preserve life in the way that he sees fit, which is by wiping out half of life. And he's been on this quest, apparently, as we learn in this movie, for quite some time, and has gone about it in different ways, and has just not had the instantaneous success that he wants. And the Infinity Gauntlet is a way for him to accelerate the process that he's seemingly gone through planet to planet, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we kind of see that in the flashbacks with Gamora later on, is that he's going around this what seems like a hugely inefficient process of planet by planet, yes, manually killing half the population. And, I mean, the universe is a big-ass place, especially as we've seen in the Marvel Universe the MCU to this point. Yeah, so here he's just trying to – probably just tired. He's like, man, this is hard work. I need to hit the fast-forward button, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, Thanos just – you know, he has a greater work ethic than we do, Nick, is all I can say, because my ass would be worn out after maybe two or three planets. I'd be like, you know what, let me take a nap for a couple centuries, maybe, and then come back to it later on. What would you do if you had the Infinity Gauntlet, Nick? That's a good question.
Oh, the same thing I would do if I had unlimited funds. Nothing. I would do nothing for the rest of my life. Because in theory,
you just see to it that-
in theory, if I had the Infinity Gauntlet, I could use it to create, you know, money, and I would just, you have unlimited funds, and then I would do nothing. I would help no one except myself.
Good Lord. I would reshape reality to where I was an attractive, successful man that might be able to win the affections of one Elizabeth Olsen.
There you go.
Who portrays the Scarlet Witch.
There you go. Maybe that too, but I mean, mostly nothing. The mostly nothing part.
Yes. Yes. And I would create the world's largest donut.
I would create the world's largest mattress, a Casper mattress, for which I mean to sleep on. And I would just sleep like 22 hours a day, I think.
Well, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
How great would that be?
Yep. It sounds like
and
the best thing.
If you miss anything, you can just turn time back and watch it.
Yep. There that is. Going back to bed now. Night, night.
Yep. Absolutely. And you know, I might even invent the world's largest Blue Chew so that everyone can enjoy the sexual satisfaction that comes from the makers of Blue Chew.
Or how about, would you rather have one giant-sized Blue Chew or 100 normal-sized Blue Chews?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. The one giant one you can just take little pieces of, but if you had the 100, you could take them more mobile. You know, you could take them wherever you went.
Yeah, you just pass them out like Halloween candy. Give them to the kids. That'd be good. That'd be good, right?
I would make it free for everybody in the entire world to get one order from 1-800-Flowers. The excellent folks at 1-800-Flowers.
That's pretty good. I would, of course, make sure that there are no messed up cars existing anymore and that everybody could use cars.com to find exactly what they needed.
That's right. That's right. And they can download the True Car app.
Yeah, True Car, cars.com, same shit. Who cares?
Absolutely. Anyway, all that being said, we've actually talked over quite a bit. As I mentioned, the lovely and talented Scarlet Witch has appeared alongside her boyfriend, android friend, the Vision, who she refers to as Viz in a nod to the comics. And we've met them. Here we see the return of Steve Rogers, a bearded, grizzled Steve Rogers, who appears more like Nomad than like Captain America here, as he is with his friends, the Falcon and a recently blonde Black Widow. Couple questions for you here, Nick. Number one, your thoughts on Steve with this new persona?
Yeah, it's good. Makes sense. He's kind of having to change up his look a little bit because, as we know, that he and his little team are on the run after the events of Civil War. They're kind of being hunted. They can't really stay in any one place for too long, so it makes sense they'd want to vary up their classic looks, which is the same reason for Scarlett Johansson's blonde hair here in this one, although I must admit I missed the red hair, but what can you do?
And he no longer has his shield.
No, remember he left it at the end of...
Yep. Civil War.
Civil War, yep, dropped it.
Yeah. Now, Black Widow's change of hair does make it easier to distinguish her in a fight scene from Scarlet Witch. Not that I'm suggesting that was the ultimate motivation for it, but that was probably the motivation for it from a production standpoint. Yeah, interesting look here at the home planet of Gamora as she's a child. We're getting this great flashback of when Thanos first took her, and we see a glimpse of the Chitauri overhead as they're launching an attack on this planet. Mm-hmm. I really love that nod back to the Avengers and tying everything together to show, as you mentioned, Thanos going through this painstaking process of manually wiping out half the life on each planet one by one.
Yeah, it was good to have some of that continuity and remind us that he does have a large fighting force to decide, even though I don't believe we see them at any point during this movie. So it makes you wonder, have all of his forces been wiped out except for the ones that attacked the Asgardian ship at the beginning? Where are they during all this? Is he wiping out half of his own forces? Because that doesn't make any sense. You know, what's his resource base here? I don't know.
We don't know. There you see the magical dagger that he gives her. I thought that the dagger was going to have a stone in it of some kind when I first watched this movie, and it didn't. It was just a dagger.
It was just a dagger. Decorative dagger.
Pretty good design, though.
Giving a small child a dangerous weapon, that's always good.
You've been there before.
Yep.
Thanos, how old is he? How old is Thanos?
We don't know. Who knows? He's a Titan. They live, you know, I'm sure they live a long time.
Is he a Tennessee Titan? Is he a member of the Titan Games on NBC hosted by The Rock?
I bet he should be a member of the Titan Games hosted by The Rock. What an excellent television program.
I'm sure it is. I haven't watched it yet, but it is.
I haven't either, but I assume because The Rock's involved that it's good.
It probably is. I think everyone watch anything The Rock's involved in and support it.
I wouldn't go quite that far. You know, he has a tendency to pair up with Kevin Hart a little too often for my taste, but other than that.
Oh, the Kevin Hart shade coming out from Nick Duke.
You know.
What a hell of a thing to say.
I've never hidden my feelings on Kevin Hart.
You just don't like him because he's the shoot height of Cotton Hill.
Hey, that being said, though, I will say he's in this. There's a preview for this movie he's going to be in. The movie actually looks good.
Yeah, the one with Bryan Cranston as
the wheelchair
guy. Yeah,
looks good.
The one with Bryan Cranston as the guy. I said
the guy in the wheelchair. Yep, yeah. There you go, Nicole Kidman.
So yeah, it does look good. Nicole, she's having I gotta say, Nick, she's having a late career renaissance.
Having a good year. It's been a good 12 months.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm interested in seeing where that goes. Now, this is a big moment, too. I actually forgot about this until I rewatched the movie, that this is actually the first time that Gamora really explores her relationship with Peter Quill. Mm-hmm. And I think – I could be wrong here, Nick. Maybe you can remember it in one of the previous movies. I believe this movie also has the first instance of her telling him that she loves him.
I don't know. Does she?
Right. She does. She tells him right before –
yeah, I can't remember if it was she also said that.
Guardians. I don't remember her ever saying that before. I think she's always kind of tiptoed around the concept, which adds a little bit of fuel to something that we'll talk about later on. This is outstanding. Who would have ever thought that Dave Bautista in a movie with this many great actors in it would stand out?
He's great. They give him some great lines, too.
Yes.
Nothing like the Drax of the comics, by the way. They're like virtually unrecognizable based on what we read in Infinity Gauntlet. Anyway.
Absolutely. And can I go ahead? Can I say it, Nick?
Better.
Yes. Better. Better than easily. The Drax of the comics.
Not even close.
Imperceptible. I'm sure I'm invisible. Oh, great. Fantastic. Yep. So... excellent usage of
back to nowhere here, where we haven't been since the first Guardians movie.
How about it? Yeah, is this where they find Thanos?
Yeah, this is where, because remember they left, or yeah. they tried to sell a stone to the collector on Nowhere in the first Guardians movie, unknowing that, that one had already been sold to him, but are given to him by the Asgardians. So we've seen this location before, but it looks like the planet has been decimated.
So what I love about this scene is what we're about to see, which is the closest that we get in this entire movie to the Infinity Gauntlet comic book from an action perspective when it comes to Thanos using the Reality Stone and turning – I think he turns Mantis into ribbons and turns Drax into these like weird cube shapes. It's awesome.
Yes.
It is absolutely awesome. It's right off the freaking comic book page.
And the first time I saw it, I thought he had actually killed them. I didn't expect
them
to be put back together or whatever.
Totally. I freaked out in the chair because I was like, no, not Drax. Not Drax. And I thought he was gone. I thought that was it. And I was surprised when he got put back together.
Yes.
That is one thing that I do I'm not going to have many criticisms of this movie, but one thing that I do agree with our buddy Tim Capel, I would have liked to have seen more creative deaths like we saw in the comics with people getting turned into abstract shapes and, you know, trees going through people and stuff like that. But that being said, I mean, I can't criticize the action in this movie. It's all great. The fight scenes are really good. And we get this scene, but I would have liked to see a little bit more of that the Reality Stone usage, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And I love this kind of almost a test by Thanos of Gamora and then of Quill later, using the Reality Stone to twist them around and make them think they killed him, and then waiting to see if Quill would actually have the guts to follow through on his promise to Gamora. And then he does. And he still doesn't get to fulfill that promise because Thanos just takes her anyway. And I think that also is building up and contributing to what we see later in the movie. Do you think you can tell Thanos' age by the wrinkles on his chin?
I have no idea. Or maybe the lines down his face.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, Quill says that he's going to blow that nutsack off of his chin, or nutsack that he calls it, off of his face. And it does somewhat resemble a nutsack, Nick.
It does. I mean, my lines on my nutsack aren't nearly as straight and symmetrical as that. But
right.
I suppose if you were to build the perfect nutsack and attach it to one's chin, that's kind of what it would look like.
It might look a little bit like that. See, I would think you'd want a smoother nutsack if you're building the ideal one.
I suppose. I mean, you need a couple wrinkles just to make it look like a nutsack, you know?
Maybe that's what an old nutsack looks like.
Maybe.
Maybe the lines get more defined as you get older. I don't know. Maybe it's like a carbon dating or whatever, you know? I don't know.
Who does know?
The Shadow knows.
Indeed. He knows what lies in the hearts of men. And he knows that now Thanos is revealing it all to have been a ruse.
Thanos, in this entire movie, not once does he encounter or even make reference to Thanatos.
No. Oh. Yeah, there's no point. There's no Poindexter anywhere in this movie, which is a problem, I think.
It is a problem. It's a big flaw. Now, Thanatos, you would think if the world's going to be ending or if half life is going to be wiped out, Thanatos would want to either be involved in this scheme or to help the heroes to preserve his own life. So where is he in all this? Does he even exist in the Marvel Universe? We don't know.
I don't know. I would assume that he did at one point, and that's actually that's where they got the extra vibranium to build Captain America's new set of shields we see at the end of this movie.
Does anyone listening to this podcast even know who we're referring to by saying Thanatos?
No. That was the answer. Oh, Eric, that was cool.
That's phenomenal. The turning into blocks. I love it. And there she turns into a jack-in-the-box, basically.
Yeah, every time we reference that, everyone's like, eh?
Yeah, nobody reacts, yeah. It's just us. That's good. That's really good.
I know it upsets me immensely when people don't react to what I say in the chat, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Hey, we got to watch Santa with Muscle someday. That reminds me.
It's excellent.
Oh, you've already seen it?
Yeah, I've seen Santa with Muscles. Come on now.
I said you had never been able to see it.
No, I've seen it.
It was
yeah.
hard to find.
No, it's they show it sometimes on like the Stars channel. So if I'm ever down home around my dad's place during the holidays, they'll always be showing. I watched it not this past Christmas, but the year before, so 2017. Yep, featuring like 12-year-old Mila Kunis and one of the kids from Beethoven, and also the guy who played Donna's dad, Bob, on That 70s Show are all in it.
Oh, yeah, I remember Bob. He had the funny hair.
Yep, he's in it. He's in the movie.
Wow.
With the funny hair.
Wow, that's a crazy thing. Oh, man, poor Peter. He's stuck with the choice of killing the woman he loves and honoring his promise to her, or allowing Thanos to get what he wants.
Plus, Santa with Muscles has just like the best premise, where it's like he's an evil rich guy, and he puts on a Santa costume because he has to for something, and then he gets hit on the head, and then when he wakes up, he's convinced that he actually is Santa Claus, and so he wants to help people, even though he was an evil billionaire before.
And he has muscles.
And he does have muscles, yes. Ed Begley Jr. is also in the movie, apparently.
You want to just do Hard Travelers for Hire on Hulk Hogan movies next?
Yes, I do. Clint Howard is in the movie.
Clint Howard?
Yes.
The Clint Howard.
Yep.
Wow, the ugliest man in Hollywood, one could argue.
Garrett Morris of Saturday Night Live fame.
Yep.
There you go. That's it. There are other people, but I don't know who any of them are.
Outstanding. Well, one movie that doesn't have Clint Howard in it is Avengers Infinity War. And here's our first look at Colonel Rhodes here, War Machine, who is arguing with the brass in Washington, as this is the first time we've seen him since the events of Civil War. And they want him to go after Captain America and his crew. Rhodes is no longer buying into the line of horse shit that is coming to him from what's his damn name? Thunderbolt Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Played here by
William Hurt.
William Hurt. Not to be confused with John Hurt.
No. Completely different.
Or Simon Hurt.
No. John Hurt. Who is John Hurt?
John Hurt's another actor. He's been in a lot of movies.
I'm looking him up right now. Let's see here. Oh, yeah, John Hurt. I know that guy. There you go.
He was in V for Vendetta. Yeah. He played the Chancellor. Yep.
Oh, and he was an alien. Yeah, okay. Oh, and he was the Elephant Man. Yeah, okay, I gotcha.
He was the Elephant Man? Michael Jackson bought his bones.
I'm reasonably sure he was the Elephant Man. Let's see here. Yeah, John Merrick, played by John Hurt, the Elephant Man.
Wow. Oh, man, we need to have a disfigured movie characters based on real life figures tournament and have the Elephant Man against Rocky Dennis.
Who?
Look up Mask movie.
Oh, God, yeah. Never mind. Why didn't you just say Matt, the guy from Mask?
Well, you knew his name was Rocky Dennis. He's famous.
No, I don't know anything about that.
Anyway, too much. That was too far, even for me.
What are we talking about?
We're way
off.
We're all over the place here. We got this great, great movie here. And, man, I feel horrible about that damn joke. I take that back. That was too bad for me.
I don't understand what was bad about it.
Well, I shouldn't have said what I said about old them, both of them. Poor folks that had disadvantaged lives.
Also, what would be the criteria for advancement in this tournament? More disfigured or less disfigured?
I was picturing some sort of a celebrity deathmatch type situation.
Oh, but God. Well, the Elephant Man could barely move, so I'm gonna give the guy from Mask the advantage here.
Why did Michael Jackson buy his bones?
Why did Michael Jackson do a lot of the things that he did? Childhood trauma is the answer.
Childhood trauma, yep. Years of abuse, boys. Years of abuse.
What are we doing?
I don't know. What are we doing? What is happening to this show?
No one knows.
Hey, apparently Michael Jackson's pimp Bubbles is getting a movie made about him.
I'm pretty sure that that movie will be illegal to be shown in most countries, if that's the case.
It says here, on Radar Online. If you can't trust Radar Online, who the hell can you trust?
Hubba, hubba, hubba.
Hubba, hubba, hubba. Who the hell can you trust? So, we're not talking about this movie, not because the movie is good.
Why would we want to talk about Avengers Infinity War on the Avengers Infinity War podcast? That makes no sense.
Right. Well, I mean, we're almost getting to the point where, like, what else is there? What is there to say? We like the movie.
We like it. It's good.
It's good.
You know?
And, you know, the Lori Morgan's hot chicken restaurant's going to open up inside it. It's going to be great.
I do think there are some, like, valid criticisms of the movie, though. I told you that I felt this way after seeing it. I don't know that it stands alone as well as some of the other MCU films.
That 100% it does not stand alone at all. That's a great point, and I'm glad you brought that up, because what do you have to have seen for seeing this movie?
Oh God,
100% you have to see Civil War.
100. I would argue 100% you have to have seen Thor Ragnarok to make that opening scene make any sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Black Panther, because otherwise you don't know who any of these characters are. Doctor Strange.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Guardians of the Galaxy 1, at least.
Yes, at least the first Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay, I would argue a better question is, what can you honestly leave out?
Yeah, I think you can leave out all three Iron Man movies, maybe. Or
I mean, you have to know who Tony Stark is.
Yeah, but you would get that from Civil War, right?
That's the thing, though. It all builds upon itself so much that you kind of like,
right?
You know,
I'd say you could cut it to one of the Iron Man movies.
Yeah, I would say Iron Man 1, so probably.
You could cut two of the Iron Man movies out,
yes.
and not watch them. You could cut out the Incredible Hulk.
Yes, movie, I would agree with that. Yes.
Yeah. You could cut out the first Captain America. I would argue, because you can get all the relevant story from Winter Soldier.
Probably, yeah.
You could cut out one of the Guardians, as we mentioned.
Two, I would think, because at least one has the stone in it, you know. And
yeah, you could cut out Ant-Man.
Yes, and yeah, absolutely, cut out Ant-Man. God, Dark World isn't good, but you kind of need to establish that why the stone is where it is and what it does and the importance of it.
You could actually not watch the first Thor movie and just watch Dark World.
Yeah, but then you it's tough, man, because the Tesseract stuff, you know, because the Thor Loki leads straight into Avengers. It's my point is
this has seldom been attempted,
right,
in movies before, where a movie is so completely dependent upon existing movies to tell its story. We've seen it before with stuff like Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, but it's usually been Part 2 or something like that,
right,
of a singular story. Very rarely has a movie been this reliant upon people having seen movies before. I don't know how anyone can make sense of this if they've never seen a Marvel movie before, but that begs the question to me, Nick, why the hell would this be your first Marvel movie that you've ever seen?
No, I don't know why it would be, but you know, there's the old adage, every comic is someone's first comic, so you kind of have to look at it from the standpoint of every movie is someone's first movie. But of course, we say that, and having not had that perspective, I'm sure there are people who went and saw this movie and were just fine. Like, they may have not gotten all of the nuance and stuff, but, you know,
you don't need to see everybody's origin story.
Right, you can follow the strokes of it. But still, I guess my larger point was, both in terms of the context of the events of the film and also the way it ends, It is the only MCU movie that I feel like doesn't really tell its own self-contained complete story from beginning to end. And that's necessarily to say I don't enjoy the movie or don't like the movie as a result of that. I'm just saying it is the one of all of them that feels more like people have said in the past that MCU movies are essentially just extended trailers for the next MCU movie. I don't agree with that criticism most of the time, and I don't even really agree with it here, but this is the one where I can kind of see it a little bit.
And I would say you could also apply every argument you just made to the most beloved
of all the Star Wars movies, Empire Strikes Back. Because it is very much reliant upon you having seen A New Hope.
Right.
And also sets up as a, you could argue, a trailer for Return of the Jedi, because there's no resolution at the end of the movie. And
that's a cool effect.
Yet it's a great, movie. I also think that this movie does tell its own story. It tells the story of Thanos, because we don't get any backstory for Thanos in the other movies in terms of his motivations, what he wants. We just get he's a bad guy. He's going to do bad things. But here we open the movie with Thanos trying to get this object, and he gets it. And the rest of the movie is Thanos on this pursuit of objects, while we also have Thor on a parallel pursuit of a different object. And then at the end of the movie, Thanos wins, and he gets his resolution. Nobody else gets resolution, but Thanos does at the end of the movie, and that's why the last shot of this film is of Thanos and not one of the protagonists.
Sure. I would tend to agree with that, but I also think there's a knowledge of, like, he gets a resolution that isn't a resolution. You know what I mean? Like, we all know that's not really his resolution.
And we know that based on our prior knowledge of these characters in this universe.
And we also know
not
that
based on the movie itself.
And we also know that based on, like, our knowledge of how franchises and
sure,
money making work these days. Like,
absolutely. Absolutely. It's much like Harry Potter. We knew he was Harry Potter ain't gonna die in the Deathly Hallows.
No. No. He's just gonna go to the train station from the Matrix and have a conversation with Gandalf for a minute.
He sure did, Stevie.
You haven't seen it.
No. I have not. One day I will watch the Harry Potter movies, but that day is not now. I'm sure they're great, and I'll watch them at some point.
They're mostly okay.
But,
also, you're never going to watch them. Don't lie to people.
Now, you know how much I watch movies on my own time with no one else around?
Mm-hmm.
Movies, yep, such as the classic 1980s softcore porno Crocodile Blondie.
Or what about the 2000, I don't know exactly what year of the 2010s, but classic 2010s comedy, The Dictator.
Mm-hmm. You know, that came on TV on one of those cable channels about a week ago, and mm-hmm, I passed through the guide, and I just kept on going.
Mm. How dare you?
Well, we need to get back to this movie at some point. And so we've talked about how we talked about the fact that there are some flaws in this movie. So that's one that you pointed out. For me, this was it's hard for me to objectively analyze this movie, objectively, like anyone objectively analyzes anything. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to look at this in a negative light because – for me, I know not everybody that loves the book had this experience, but for me, this was almost this out-of-body experience watching this in the theater and even rewatching it detached all these months later. I didn't have the same visceral reaction that I had in the theater any of the times that I watched it, but there was that experience of, like, I never thought I would see this, like, 7 years old, reading the Infinity Gauntlet and just imagining it playing out in motion and imagining how it would look, and to finally see this play out the way that it did, and to see them go with the ending of Thanos winning, basically. Not even basically, but winning, completely winning at the end of this movie. It almost was enough to bring a tear to my eye! Because it was kind of fulfilling this fantasy that I had when I was a little boy that I never thought I would see. And for my money, it moves at a really good pace. I think with all the story that they're trying to tell here, and there's a lot of story here, I think it does the best job that I can think of cramming so many characters into one movie. We all wondered how they would do this, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
We wondered how they would fit all these characters in. And I thought they did it marvelously. And by they, of course, I'm referring to the Russo brothers that directed this, Joe and Anthony Russo.
Well, they did it because you have to pick characters that you can't really place a large amount of emphasis on. Like, you can have them there, but, like, there isn't enough time to give Bucky Barnes of his own little subplot. You know, there isn't enough time
right.
for Black Widow or the Falcon, as we alluded to earlier, to have their own subplots. Honestly, there wasn't really a ton of time for Steve Rogers to have his own subplot. Like, you know, there's a lot mm-hmm. of characters in this movie who get short shrift, and I think that's because they know they can't afford the screen time.
Right.
But again, there's a second kind of a conclusion to this film coming up here in a few months, so we'll see how it all plays out for those characters that I just alluded to.
And we all knew that was going to happen.
Right.
So, yeah.
For as much as they kept saying, this is not part one of a two-part film, this is definitely part one of a two-part film.
Totally. I think the only question we had going in was, will they wipe out Thanos in one movie?
Right.
And I would argue it is very good that they did not.
Right.
I would have been disappointed if they had wiped out Thanos at the end of this movie. Like, say Thor had succeeded mm-hmm. when he hits him with the Stormbreaker, right, is the name of it, mm-hmm. at the end of the movie.
It's what they call it, the Stormbreaker.
So I would have been disappointed if that had been the end of Thanos. So I'm happy that he won here. Happy that, for once, a villain in the MCU comes out on top, and things don't look promising for the guys at the end of this. There's really no hope left at the end of this movie. It really does feel like the heroes are utterly defeated, and I'm excited about that. I thought it was quite compelling to see and quite interesting to see moving forward. And certainly the heroes will come back, but it's how the heroes will come back from this defeat, how they will rebound, and how they will undo Thanos, who's played to perfection by Josh Brolin. And we got to give credit. I got to give credit anyway to the special effects team here for making Thanos look like a living, breathing creature and not a fake piece of CGI.
The MCU are the best in the business when it comes to CGI at this point, whether it's this effect that we're seeing here with Nebula kind of being disassembled and levitating in air, or it's their fully CG creations, or the aforementioned, or not in this podcast, but that technique we talked about so many times with the de-aging of certain characters for flashbacks, mm-hmm. or even in their practical effects, like something with Gamora right here with this practically applied makeup job. Their special effects are outstanding across the board. Nobody in movie making that I've seen does it better, honestly.
Agreed. And certainly up until Aquaman, we have not seen DC even approach it in any of their movies. So, yeah, outstanding stuff here from the MCU, from the Russos, and their entire team. Kind of winding down a little bit on the back end of this movie, we get one of the key debates about this movie revolves around the character of Peter Quill. Because there's a moment coming up where the heroes have Thanos. Mantis has subdued him mentally, emotionally, whatever you want to say. The other heroes are holding him. Peter and Iron Man are very close to getting the Infinity Gauntlet removed from Thanos' hand. And Peter finds out via Nebula that Gamora's gone, that Thanos has killed Gamora to sacrifice her for the Soul Stone. And in that moment, in a rage, he lashes out at Thanos, and it breaks Thanos from Mantis's trance and allows him to regain control and, as we find out by the end of the movie, wipe out half the life in the known universe. And, I suppose, unknown universe. Mm-hmm. Many people now view this as Peter Quill, or as either one of two things: Peter Quill being a garbage character for doing that, or bad writing on the team for not writing Peter Quill to analyze that situation more. As I kind of alluded to earlier, my feeling on that, and you may disagree with this, Nick, my feeling on that is this is all foreshadowed in both of the Guardians movies, and even the beginning of this movie. Peter Quill, from the time we meet him, is the most human, and I mean that in the rawest and most negative sense, the most human character, hero character, in the entire MCU. No one reacts as emotionally as him. No one reacts as viscerally as him to the things around him. because he's still the same scared little boy that he was when his mother died. And I would argue that in every key moment in both Guardians movies, Star-Lord has reacted emotionally and has made mistakes. Think about the moment when he confronts Ego, a living planet that, for all we know, can end his life with a moment's thought. And he steps up to him and attacks him because he killed his mom. And that's what I took this as. This was a moment of emotional reaction from a guy who is very, very emotional. And he wasn't thinking when he lashed out at Ego, and he's not thinking when he lashes out at Thanos. And unfortunately, it of course ends up being a bad move and something that I'm sure he will regret later on. But it was it felt true to his character. I'll say that.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you, although I can certainly understand why others might have an issue with it. And I have to admit, during a large portion of your monologue you just went on, I was taken in by this Thor scene, which I would argue is one of the best emotional Thor scenes they've ever put in the MCU, period, mm-hmm. and is the scene that I feel like kind of recontextualizes most of the character changes from Ragnarok and makes them a bit more palatable for me by having him actually show some genuine emotion and say that he's kind of at the end of his rope here. What more does he have left to lose? Great stuff. Outstanding stuff on the part of the Russos to put this in the movie.
Yeah. We maybe haven't talked about him enough, because I think this is really Chris Hemsworth's – not his movie, because there's so many great stars in it that do a great job. But Chris Hemsworth gives a tour de force performance in this at Thor. One of his best turns as the character, which is saying a lot because we have huge praise for him in all these movies. But he is called upon to deliver emotionally, to deliver as a badass, and to deliver comedy. And he does all three in spades.
Yeah, he's great. Not played for his as uproarious laughter as he was in Ragnarok, but a little bit more of some understated humor that's really good, and of course, like I just said, the emotion. And then later on, when he gets to cut loose in the action scene, I think it's the best
Thor. One of the coolest moments. Yeah, you said it was the best Thor action scene on screen.
Easily, to me anyway. The moment that they've come closest to having like peak comics Thor on screen, where he just unleashes mm-hmm. and is treated as like a complete badass, where Banner stands up and goes, "Oh, you guys are so screwed now." Good stuff.
Yeah, indeed.
What the hell?
And
what the hell is going on?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew, Nick.
Greg's side of the L-shaped studios have been invaded by a crew from PetSmart, apparently.
Yes. it appears there's no defusing that. But nonetheless, the all of that is good. Thor is good. He just, oh yeah, the great moment where he wrecks shit on everybody at the end of the movie is fantastic. And he shows up and just brings the hammer of the gods down upon them. Mm-hmm. Needed Zeppelin, but otherwise excellent. And we talked a little bit about Peter Quill. Yeah, there's lots of criticism. It's hard for me to objectively talk about the movie because I love it so much. It's so near to my heart. But what else do we need to talk about before we get to our go-home cue here?
I don't really know. Can't think of anything because my sick brain is not firing on all cylinders.
Yes, all of us have been getting down. Not me yet. I've somehow managed to avoid it at this point. But a great number of people have gotten down with the sickness lately.
Yep, down with the
sickness. And mm-hmm. Something down with the sickness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing right now is buying time to try to pull up the list of our movie rankings for Hard Travelers for Hire. And I think I've successfully done that. So, with that being said, I love this movie. I really do. It's been a question to me of where it would rank. When I first saw it, I thought, without question, it's my number one in the MCU because of the emotional effect that it had on me. It still has an emotional effect on me to a degree because of the nostalgia and the sense of wonder and the fact that I am such a fan of going big in these movies, going grand in these movies. I remember the feeling in the first Avengers movie, and I got that same feeling even to a higher level in this movie because it was recreating something. It was doing something I didn't know could ever be done with so many characters and so many great interactions, seeing the Guardians interact with the classic Avengers, all these new characters interacting, Wakanda as the battlefield, just so much to love about this movie. It's a special one for me.
Yeah, I also enjoy it immensely. You know, I do like – I've realized as we've gone throughout this project that I prefer my MCU movies where we get a little bit more character development than I think we got here, just because there's no time really for character development other than perhaps, as you said, Thanos. But still a movie I enjoy immensely, and yeah, not a whole lot really bad to say about it. Just for me – upon reflection, probably still not in that upper tier of Marvel movies. But again, part of that is because it feels a tad incomplete to me. I wonder if perhaps Endgame might not help this to retroactively rise in my rankings down the road at some point. But for now, I have it where I have it, which we'll unveil in just a moment.
Indeed so. So let's get to it. This is where we reveal our rankings, and we start with the critical rankings of the MCU to this point. So, Nick, let the folks at home listening to our show, or wherever they may be, hear about the critical consensus about this film, and fan consensus, by the way.
And I'll be happy to do that in just a moment, as I stall for time, much like Greg often does. Let me see here. 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, so here we go. As you guys know, the way we do this, we combine the Rotten Tomatoes score, the Metacritic score, and the IMDb score, all on a scale of 1 to 100, meaning a film can have a maximum of 300 points. So here we go. In reverse order, from now 19, I believe that's right. Mm-hmm. Counting again to make sure that's right. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yep, 19. To one. Here we go. At number 19, Thor the Dark World with 190 points. At number 18, The Incredible Hulk with 196 points. At 17, Iron Man 2 with 200 points. At 16, Thor with 204 points. At 15, Iron Man 3 with 213. At 14, Captain America the First Avenger with 214. At 13, Age of Ultron with 215. At 12, Ant-Man with 219. At 11, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 with 227. At 10, Doctor Strange with 236. A tie for 8th. A tie for 8th, Greg, between Avengers Infinity War and Captain America the Winter Soldier with 237th. So that's interesting. There you go. So here are the films that are ranked ahead of Avengers Infinity War. At number 7, Spider-Man Homecoming with 240. At number 6, The Avengers with 242. At number 5, Captain America Civil War with 244. At number 4, Thor Ragnarok with 245. At number 3, Guardians of the Galaxy with 248. At number 2, Iron Man with 251. And at number 1, Black Panther with 259.
Very good, Nick. Good work there, gathering all that and hunting it down and doing all the math in your head as well. Excellent job. Well, let's get to our personal rankings and see how recency bias affects us. And I will start us out then and at what you refer to as number 19, correct? 19 films. At number 19, I have Doctor Strange. At number 18, I have The Incredible Hulk. At number 17, I have Thor, The Dark World. At number 16, I have Thor. At number 15, Captain America, The First Avenger. At number 14, Ant-Man. At number 13, Spider-Man Homecoming. At number 12, Iron Man. At number 11, Iron Man 3. At number 10, Iron Man TU. At number 9, Avengers Age of Ultron. At number 8, Black Panther. At number 7, Guardians of the Galaxy. At number 6, Marvel's The Avengers. At number 5, Thor Ragnarok. Number 4, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2. At number 3, Captain America, The Winter Soldier. At number 2, Avengers, Infinity War. And at number 1, still, Captain America, Civil War.
Interesting. Good stuff. Well, okay stuff, I suppose. Here's a better list. 19, Ant-Man. At number 18, Iron Man 3. At number 17, The Incredible Hulk. At 16, Thor the Dark World. At 15, Doctor Strange. At 14, Iron Man 2. At 13, Thor Ragnarok. At 12, Captain America the First Avenger. At 11, Thor. At 10, Black Panther. At 9, Iron Man. At 8, Avengers Infinity War. Coming in 8th for me. At 7, Guardians of the Galaxy. At 6, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. At 5, Spider-Man Homecoming. At 4, The Avengers. At 3, Avengers Age of Ultron. At 2, Captain America Civil War. And at 1, still reigning atop my rankings, Captain America the Winter Soldier.
Quite frankly, you have a right to rank Age of Ultron that many spots ahead of Infinity War, even if it's wrong.
Well, quite frankly. Again, I have a feeling, I honestly believe that once we see Endgame, my entire outlook on Infinity War may change, because I the incompleteness of it bothers me more than it does you.
Interesting. Did you feel that way about other middle chapters of movies, like Lord of the Rings or Star Wars?
No. Well, Star Wars on when I was a kid, so you can't really, again, assess that way then. Lord of the Rings, no, because Lord of the Rings always, like, you knew that was one big, long thing, you know what I mean? And they hadn't really done standalone entries leading up to it. I think that's the thing, is Lord of the Rings, we all knew, like, it was one, you know, ideally, I mean, if you could, you would watch it as one 12-hour long story, because it really is one story from beginning to end.
So what you're saying is that we need to gather us and David Sunday and watch the entirety of The Lord of the Rings.
Yes. The extended,
to really get
well,
the whole story.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying we need to get us and David Sunday and watch the extended editions of the entire Hobbit trilogy to really get the context. And
the context
then,
and the backstory.
Right, and then watch the entire extended edition of the Lord of the Rings trilogies. And then attend a spoken reading, a live reading of the various appendices that are included in the Lord of the Rings novels that will really give you all the historical context for the events that take place.
And then listen to the remix edition of A Song About Pissing.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Very good. Well, folks, there you have it. Our appraisals of Avengers Infinity War. Both of us greatly enjoyed the film to different degrees. Let us know your thoughts. What do we get wrong? What do we get right? You can tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. You can email us, gregp@playstabination.com, nickd@playstabination.com. You can join Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook. Join us there to join the discussion. And also, we're far from the first ones to talk about this this movie. Several other of our cohorts here at PTBN Comics have talked about it. Tim Capel has given his thoughts on it. You can find that on a reaction show here on Place to Be Nation Pop.
I was Jennifer on that as Smith, well with those two, and, Jennifer Smith.
And you were on that as well, and Jennifer Smith as well was on that. So be sure to check that out and let us all know what you think. Whose opinions are you in with? Whose are you out with? What did we miss about this movie? We talked a lot about other things besides this movie while talking about it. But hey, we're in recovery mode right now, folks. We're in the 10th circle of hell, and the holidays are like that for everyone, so, for at least in our experience. So, you know. Take your eggnog and drive yourself out to the middle of nowhere and leave yourself for dead. And when we return from the break, folks, we will have reading, we will have watching, And you damn well betcha that we'll have the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place B Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceBNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place B Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaceBNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceBNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceBNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the back half of the show. We thank you for sticking around with us this long. We thank you for your patience as our tired ramblings have continued. And we are here to talk to you, really, about the rundown.
Oh, welcome to that rundown, the kooky, kooky rundown. Yeah.
That's right, the rundown, our weekly look at the news, the PN news and notes in the world of comics. And, Nick, why don't we start right out of the gates with our beloved CWDC Universe. Why don't we do that?
Let's do that.
Because a report came out just this week on Newsarama, and it says that the CW has officially ordered a pilot based on Ruby Rose's Batwoman, who made her debut as part of the Elseworlds crossover event. And no big surprise here, Nick. We all knew this was coming, but definitely good to see it made official.
Yeah, this is exciting. Although I wonder, I'm a little surprised they're even making this go to pilot. I thought for sure it'd be one of those straight to series things. So
I thought so too.
I'm a little bit like as excited as I am for the show, and I hope it gets picked up. The fact that they're making them go through the pilot stage worries me a little bit. But hopefully, it's just pessimism on my part and not an actual chance of this not happening.
Now, if the CW cancels Legends and does not pick up Batwoman, I'm going to say it. The CW could end up making the list.
Well, making the list. In that case, just move everything to to DC Universe is what I would
exactly say. Because they don't. The CW's done right. They've done very well by DC Comics fans. We have nothing to complain about from them, for the, other than shitty scheduling, right? Mm-hmm. But they're teetering, and if in terms of like there's a fine line where they'll become like Cartoon Network. They don't want to become like Cartoon Network.
No.
For comic book fans.
No, fuck the Cartoon Network.
Fuck the Cartoon Network. Also, the pilot will reportedly be directed by our favorite director, Nick, David Nutter.
Well, if it has certain scenes in it, we'll probably be David Nutters.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Holy balls, Nick, and we'll get to that in a little bit,
man,
too.
Oh, man. I don't even
know. Yeah, it's sad, but we have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we don't want to talk about it, but we will. The Punisher. The Punisher is a character from Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. He had a television series on Netflix.
He still does, in fact. Technically.
And it had a first season that was very well received by many. I have not yet watched, but I'm excited to at some point. Anyway, season two is on the way, and we got our first look at it this week with a teaser trailer of sorts that's really just images of Frank Castle walking around and you know, talking in a grim manner. And we get our first look at Ben Barnes as Jigsaw. Mm-hmm. I am super pumped for all of The Punisher. I haven't seen season one yet, but I'm super pumped to watch it. And I feel like this is the best version of Frank Castle that we've ever gotten on screen. Just from the way that he carries himself, the swagger. I will say, though, Nick, that's a weak, if that's how he's going to end up looking on the show, it's a pretty weak-ass look for Jigsaw.
I have a sneaking suspicion there's going to be more to it than that, but we'll have to wait and see how it all plays out. A lot of these Netflix designs wind up being, you know, start as one thing and kind of gradually evolve as the show goes on. So here's hoping that'll be the case here as well. But I'm pumped for this. After season one, the Jigsaw look notwithstanding, they have all of my buy-in and all of my faith because season one was so damn good. So pumped for this here in just a couple weeks.
I hope that this is not the end of this version of The Punisher. I really do. I hope that
obviously
it's going to be the end on Netflix.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that this is not the end of seeing him as Frank Castle and seeing, you know, that particular take on the character, because Frank's a character that they've really rarely gotten 100% right. I really like the Thomas Jane movie, but certainly it's a softer around the edges Frank Castle than what you would expect. Punisher Warzone was a nightmare of a movie. Dolph Lundgren was basically playing just.
There are those though, Greg. There are those like who are big Punisher fans who swear by Warzone and think that it's like the closest thing they've ever gotten to the ideal version of the Punisher.
I tried, Nick. I tried. They used to show it on Spike TV pretty frequently after UFC events and stuff, and it would come on. I tried to watch it. I find it virtually unwatchable. It's so weirdly filmed. It looks like Catwoman to me in a lot of ways in terms of the film stock that's used and everything. It doesn't look like a movie. It looks like a British soap opera or something at times. Well, it's very strange.
It makes me feel any better. That director is the one attached to that Chris Benoit movie that's never going to happen.
I know. Yeah, I heard about that. The one where, what is it, Liam Neeson's going to play Vince or something?
I don't know.
We'll have to see how that goes. In any event, maybe Kevin Hart can play Cotton Hill in a live-action King of the Hill movie.
I think he has certain qualities that would prevent him from playing that role. But you know,
good point.
A reimagining of Hank Hill as a black man, that would be interesting.
Cedric the Entertainer as Hank Hill.
As Hank Hill, yep. There you go. Queen Latifah as Peggy Hill.
I could see it. That's not bad. Now, who would be...
A young, fat, black kid as Bobby Hill.
Whatever happened to the kid from The Nutty Professor? Is he still a kid? I know that's not how time works, but...
Time travel. Go back and get him. Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah. We just need a Boomhauer.
Get the kid who played young Biggie Smalls in Notorious. That'd be fine.
This is all good.
Yep.
This is all good stuff. Where was I? Yes, the end of the rundown. That's all we got this week.
No, there's one more thing.
No, it's not. There's one more thing because we haven't talked about it yet, even though I had it pulled up and just dropped the window for no apparent reason. We're going to move to the world of comics because we got a report that came out that just very shortly after the removal of the Benson sisters as the writer of DC Comics' Green Arrow, we found out that DC's Green Arrow ongoing series will be ending with March's number 50. This is, again, literally just a couple months, really, after the Benson sisters were unceremoniously removed from the title and replaced with a new creative team. Well, the series co-writer Jackson Lansing, part of that new creative team, tweeted that this will be the end of the series. They would have loved to craft a robust, long run for Ollie and Dinah, but the universe had other plans. and he looks forward to reading them as a fan. He said, he also said, very cool things are on the horizon. And Nick, nothing about this sounds good to me.
No, no, it sounds like more Dan DiDio bullshit. Sounds like a Nightwing-esque overhaul is on the horizon for Green Arrow, which makes no sense, dude. Because like, do they not remember how reviled the New 52 version of that character was until Jeff Lemire came on and like kind of just ignored everything that came before it? And then how beloved and how well received a more classic version of the character was when Rebirth started. Like the further you get away from this version of the character, the less people like it, and that's pretty much been proven throughout the character's entire publishing history. Like, if you date back to his solo series, which began in the wake of the Longbow Hunters, the darkest times in Green Arrow history have come when they've tried to stray away from Ollie and Dinah together. It comes during the Connor Hawk stuff, or it comes when they split up after the end of their marriage, you know, in the late 2000s. Rebirth got this thing back on track and felt like, as so many things during Rebirth did, a love letter to longtime fans. And here we go again with, it's time to shake things up a bit. Gotta disturb the status quo, bro.
Yeah, it feels like every lesson that they said they had learned when Rebirth started was in fact not a lesson learned at all. It was a Geoff Johns doing something cool, and then the minute he's gone, all right, that didn't work. Let's do something else again.
Yep.
I hate it. I hate everything about it. And I hate it because I love DC Comics. I love the characters. But it just – and I don't want to be reactionary because I'm not reading enough of the titles to really know what's going on in them. But I will say that when you look at it from a macro perspective, it sure feels to me – and maybe I'm way off base here, Nick, but it feels to me like we're getting so far away from the core of that promise of what Rebirth was that had so many people so energized about DC Comics. And I'm not really – I can't say that I'm overly thrilled about the direction of anything right now in DC. Maybe, you know, I gotta catch up on Green Lantern and see what's going on there. I haven't read Shazam yet. I bought the first issue. But as far as like the main, and I'm not reading Brian Bendis' Superman, so I shouldn't comment on that. But as far as these characters that I have an attachment to, whether it be Green Arrow, whether it be Nightwing, The Flash, gosh, it's Guy Gardner and people like that. It's awful hard to get excited about what's going on in DC right now.
I tend to agree. There are a few bright spots here and there. You know, you and I disagree about the Tom King stuff, and you know, you have Doomsday Clock, which is still ongoing, and as you said, Shazam.
Yes.
But it feels like the things that we were so excited about just 3 years ago are not really a part of the company's direction at this point.
Right. It feels like we're like you said, to use the shaking things up bit analogy, it feels like we're leaving the Attitude Era and entering the Ruthless Aggression Era. And whether that's a good thing is up to the viewer to decide. But I don't know. We'll see what happens here. But nonetheless, that is the end of the rundown. We have no more running down to do. But we do have a segment where we talk about everything that we've read and watched comic book related in recent memory. It's a segment that we, of course, like to call Reading and Watching.
Reading. Watching. What have you been reading and watching? Oh, yeah.
Nick, what have you been reading?
Nothing.
Samesies. I have Shazam number one, but I haven't read it yet.
Well, I got a big ass stack of comics that I haven't read yet. I'll work on them at some point, I guess.
Me too. Well, what you been watching?
Man, I watched a lot of stuff. So, following on from our last episode where we did reading and watching, which has been a few weeks now, as you know, I completed Iron Fist season 2 on Netflix, and so I just moved right on to the next thing there on the Netflix machine, the Marvel Netflix machine, and I finally got around to Daredevil Season 3. This is a season that has enjoyed a lot of critical praise, but has had a little bit of, you know, a little bit of a more mild response from our good friend Tim Capel, who's a big Daredevil fan. I held his opinions on Daredevil in very high esteem, so I was not really sure what to expect coming into the season. And you have not seen it yet. I hope that you will watch it at some point, so I will keep my – I will try not to spoil anything to the best of my ability. Suffice it to say, I fucking love this season. It's tough for me in terms of whether it's better than season one or not, but I think it's right there with season one. It, to me, enters that – if you're talking about the Marvel Netflix seasons, I have Jessica Jones season one on like this tier unto itself. But this is right there for me, Daredevil season one, Punisher season one, and Jessica Jones season two, in terms of just outstanding television. The kind of television that we were so excited about the Marvel Netflix universe producing back when Daredevil season one, you know, first dropped. I can't really say enough good things about it. Something interesting to do for virtually all of the main cast. Vincent D'Onofrio continues to be amazing as this version of the Kingpin. Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock continues to knock it out of the park. I forget the guy's name who plays Foggy, but Foggy is great. Karen Page is even better, I think, in this season. And good stuff all around. Good stuff all around.
How much does she cry?
She cries some, I mean, but she is put through quite the set of circumstances in the season, and we get the reveal of her backstory as well that has been teased out for a little while, which is different than the one from the comics, but one works for me. So it's good stuff.
Very good. I am looking forward to watching this season at some point.
And an outstanding version of Bullseye. Like, love the way they do introduce Bullseye. A little bit of heavy-handedness at times in his flashbacks, but other than that, great, great character.
Does Vanessa show up?
I mean, do you want me to tell you?
No, don't tell me. That was just an excuse to say Vanessa. I am looking forward to watching this at some point. As you know, I wasn't super high on season two of Daredevil, but I love season one, and I generally like most of the cast. And so I'm going to watch it at some point. I just, you know, I get things on whether I have to watch Defenders before I watch it. And I'm really not excited about watching Defenders. So that's another thing a hurdle I have to overcome. Do you feel I have to watch Defenders before I watch Daredevil?
Yeah, I kind of feel like you need to see like where he went and what happened to him and the context of it all. Yes.
Fair enough. I shall endeavor to.
Defenders is not bad. Like, I don't know why people, you know, Iron Fist is more of a chore because it's longer, and plus Defenders is only eight episodes. Like, I don't think you'll dislike Defenders. I just don't think you'll be blown away by it.
Well, I'll try to read the Wikipedia summary of Iron Man or Iron Fist season one or Iron Man season one.
Just watch Iron Fist, Greg. No, I need your thoughts on the Meachums and the fuck all shit, fuck shit junk they were up to during season one.
And then I will move on to Defenders, Punisher. I really want to watch Punisher. I'm so excited to watch
Punisher. You can watch without anything. Like, Punisher doesn't really tie into the other shows at all. So I would just watch Punisher by itself if you wanted to.
And then JJ season two, super excited for, because like you, season one of Jessica Jones is my favorite of all the Netflix stuff to this point. So there's just so much to watch. But yeah, I'm looking forward to Daredevil. What else have you been watching?
I picked back up on DC Universe's Titans and finished the entire first season. I had only seen the first two episodes, so I jumped back in with whatever the third episode was, and then watched it through its conclusion over the course of a few days. And I liked it. I don't think I liked it as much as other people that we have talked to did. I know Russell is a big fan. I know Todd Weber, the manager, was a big fan. To me, I think it has pacing issues, especially in the back half of the season when it decides to take these very weird, random episode-long asides right in the midst of like all the action coming to a head with the main plot, and you kind of leave that behind for an entire episode. It's a little frustrating in that regard. I also think that it's very concerned with like building this expansive universe sometimes at the expense of the story it is trying to tell. as well done as I think the Hawk and Dove origins were, ultimately, in my opinion, they don't really play any kind of a big role in the story of what season one was. Same thing goes for the Doom Patrol, honestly. Like, I know you were a big fan of that that episode. It didn't work as well for me, but it just felt like this unnecessary detour. I'm hesitating because I don't want to give too much away about the ending. It becomes especially frustrating that we got these detours when I feel like the season had more story to tell. I'll put it that way. And I feel like they could have used the real estate that they had in those 11 episodes a little bit better in to tell a more focused story. But that being said, the performances are mostly good. The writing is mostly good. Even if there is a twist near the end that I think everyone has been coming. But it, at the very least, I think it builds an interesting foundation. I am interested to see more, but I am worried that, you know, they haven't said anything about a season two yet. So to end the season the way they did, you would hope they were going to follow up relatively quickly. And I fear they may lose a little momentum, in between now and whenever that season two may come, but let's just all wait and see how it plays out, I suppose.
Yes, let's revisit this topic next week as I plan on catching up on the last three episodes over this weekend, and we'll discuss more perhaps on next week's
edition. What happened? What was the last thing that you saw?
The last episode that I saw would have been Donna Troy introduction episode.
Okay,
and it yeah.
Okay, cool.
I think that's right. So there's three more left.
Yes, that is accurate. Yeah, because then you have a Starfire-focused episode and then two more episodes after that. So,
at any point do we get a Starfire episode?
No, but that's coming whenever we do the Southern expansion of DC Universe.
Well played. All right, what else have you been watching?
Not really new information, but I also, because the first three episodes of Young Justice Season 3 are finally out there on DC Universe, I've been rewatching Young Justice from the beginning because I want to try to remind myself of everything that happens. I'm about two-thirds of the way through Season 1 thus far, and my thoughts from all those years ago return. Fuck Cartoon Network for ever canceling this show. It was excellent. It provided something unique in animated entertainment, I think, in terms of a show that kids and parents could watch together. And it reminds you that kids will enjoy things like this because kids aren't stupid. I don't know. I love the show. Can't wait for season three. And we'll talk about that whenever I get there, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And now DC Universe is showing episodes of Green Lantern, the animated series.
Right.
Which... You know, I'm not saying that there's a chance that it could happen, but boy, it would be great if they brought that show back.
Yeah, it would. Yes, it would. We'll see. Maybe. I'm not going to get my hopes up, though. I feel like getting one resurrection was already unlikely enough. What are the odds?
Yes, miraculous.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Looking forward to season three of Young Justice. Anything else that you've been viewing or watching?
No.
As for me, I rewatched Black Panther, watched it with my parents who had not seen it. They both enjoyed the film, and of course it remains excellent, as we've talked about here on the show. And that's about it, I think. I watched a few minutes of Justice League on TV. It came on HBO while I was home, and you know, there's still some things I like and still some things that I really don't like, and we've talked about that. We had so much praise for the CGI in Infinity War earlier, Nick, and so much praise for the CGI in Aquaman last week. Holy Lord, Justice League has some of the worst in a modern. I mean, it's CGI that looks like. So while I was home, I rewatched for the first time in a long time the movie I Am Legend.
Yeah,
a movie that has legendarily bad CGI, but has a good movie around it.
Right.
Well, Justice League is a not good movie surrounded by I Am Legend level CGI.
Yes.
Well, here's the problem. I Am Legend came out over a decade ago.
Yes.
And Justice League looks like a film that was made over a decade ago. So anyway, that's just an interesting interesting thing there. I didn't watch the whole thing. There are still some things that I like about the movie, but it's just, gosh. I feel like it's a movie, Nick, that's going to get worse as it ages.
I had no doubt of that as soon as I walked out of the theater, because I remember, like, I have not seen it since, but I know that walking out of the theater, I went, that was okay, I guess. And I knew it was going to be one of those movies that the negative was going to stick with me a lot more than the positive was. As we sit here today, I'm struggling to remember any of the positive from it. Wonder Woman, I feel confident it was probably still pretty good. Jason Momoa's Aquaman, and
the scene where they're sitting around and he has the lasso around him and doesn't realize it.
That was
good.
Yep, and then of course Superman near the end of the film when he shows up.
Superman, yeah, when he finally arrives, yeah, Superman was very good. But and really any of the stuff with Lois was good. But yeah, not a large percentage of the film for sure.
No,
and give me none of the Ezra Miller Barry Allen. I don't want it.
Not for me. Nope.
Not for me.
Not.
I'm actually lower on it now than I was then.
It's the worst thing in that film, and that's a bad film. Like
I have just seen The Flash in a good Justice League on Elseworlds. That's my Flash. That's all I need.
Yep.
So, anyway, that's all I've got for watching as well. So let's bring an end, a merciful end to our long ramblings here. But before we go, before we end the show, we will give you, first of all, a preview of what's to come in the coming weeks. We have a countdown coming up of the worst character changes in comics. Mm-hmm. Not sure when we're going to drop that one, but it's on the schedule to do at some point. That should be a fun one. We are tentatively planning, and as I mentioned, tentatively, because we always have the ability to change our schedule up at a moment's notice, we are planning to review a book that is near and dear to the heart of one, the stone-cold heart of one Nicholas Duke. And that's a book called Batman R.I.P. And you see, this is penance to Mr. Duke for forcing me to read Hush Returns all those months ago.
Last year, one year ago.
So we'll see if we can work that in. Hopefully we'll get to that this month. And keep an eye out, folks. We got some stuff coming your way. But let's head to our segment we usually step aside for the wrestling moment, but really what we want to talk about is the unfortunate passing of Mean Gene Okerlund this week. For my money, the very best that there's ever been at what he did. There's never been a wrestling interviewer or host that had the personality or contributed as much to the show as did Mean Gene. What a lot of people remember about him is, you know, him standing for interviews and asking questions to Hogan or Savage or whoever. But what a lot of people may not remember, except the more hardcore wrestling fans, is just how damn funny the guy was. One of the funniest people who has ever been in the business.
Impeccable timing, whether it was in his more serious responses to questions, his timing of the questions, or his comedic reaction to things. One of the best improvisers, and in subtle ways, nothing that you would ever, you know, that he was never the focus of any segment he was ever in, but one of the best improvisers and just, you know, best all around to ever do it is all I can say. Voice of my childhood is something that I think has gotten overplayed by a lot of people in years. Cause you could really say that about Gorilla Monsoon or Bobby Heenan or any number of mm-hmm. wrestling personalities. But if you're going to say that, it applies just as much to Mean Gene as it does to any of those guys. So huge, huge loss.
Yeah. Yeah. And even as simple as it is, the subtle comedy of listening to an insane over the top rant from the Ultimate Warrior backstage that is talking about gods and planes and, you know, other dimensions, and Mean Gene's just sitting there tapping his chin with his finger as if it's the most compelling idea he's ever heard in his life.
And occasionally cutting his eyes into the camera, you know.
Yep. Yeah, just like it was – there's just a level of absurdist humor there that works and always worked from him that no one else has ever really gotten. No phony smile, just – and then, of course, when he got a chance to really show his personality, whether it's the blooper reels you can find on YouTube or whether it was even in some of the promos that made the air talking about going to a pole vaulting competition in Ric Flair's suite or telling Sean O'Hare to blow it out his ass. there's just so many great memories for him. So he will be missed dearly. And luckily, we're in an era where we can go on and watch pretty much anything he ever did on the WWE Network. So I'm planning on enjoying some of that hopefully this weekend. But also in the wrestling world, neither of us have had a chance to watch it yet, but Wrestle Kingdom 13 is airing, has aired actually this morning. And neither of us have had a chance to watch it, Nick, but I'm really excited for that show. I'm actually, as soon as we get off the air, I'm going to fire that up and start watching as much as I can.
Sounds like a plan. I'm looking forward to it as well.
And with that being said, folks, that will wrap up the Wrestling Minute. Mm-hmm. And we will jump back into our usual strategy next week, talking more about the weekend events in WWE and maybe a little bit of All Elite Wrestling, which
we can touch on that. Good point.
A burgeoning thing that we need to discuss, but that we'll save that for a week when we have more more time.
But you know, as we sign off here, as we do each and every week here on the old hard traveling airwaves, gonna exit with a little musical number from Jim Ross. You can actually hear the band getting set up in the background. That's what all the rattling and stuff is. They're moving equipment onto the stage. JR likes his stage set up a certain way, which you can't blame. Art is art. But a little special treat here this week as JR is going to be joined by a couple of friends here. There's a couple spoken word parts in this in this number, from what I understand. I don't know who the friends are. They're special guests that he's just going to kind of bring it on his own. So your guess is as good as mine, folks. I'm on the edge of my seat wondering who's going to walk through the door of the L-shaped studio. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to JR and his amazing friends.
Well, once again, I wish I could say that I was happy to be here, but I'm not. You see, I would rather be in Norman, Oklahoma, enjoying a crisp winter breeze, sitting here thinking about Baker Mayfield and what he is going to do in the 2018-19 NFL season. But instead, I'm here in the Hard Traveling Studios. Nothing else to do with my life. So I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to sing you a little tune that I used to hear on the radio quite a bit. I used to sit here, and I used to listen to it quite often. And it goes a little something. Well, it goes like this. Hello, everyone. This is your Action News Reporter with all the news that is news across the nation. On the screen and the scene at the supermarket. Well, it seems to have been some disturbance here. Pardon me, sir. Did you see what happened?
Yeah, I did. I was standing over there by the tomatoes, and here he come, running the old beans, through the fruits and vegetables, naked as a jaybird. And I hollered over to Ethel. I said, "Don't look, Ethel," but it's too late. She'd already been incensed.
Here he comes. Look at that. Look at that. There he goes. Look at that. Look at that. And he ain't wearing no clothes. Yes, they call him the Streak. Look at that. Look at that. The fastest thing on 2 feet. He's just as proud as he can be of his anatomy. And he's going to give us pink, quite frankly. Just like Naked Midian. Now, Naked Midian was a character that, oh, I get it. Oh, he's naked. It's funny. But Naked Midian had legs, ladies and gentlemen. Naked Midian was a character that drew the third largest rating in the month of February in the history of this business. Oh, yes, they call him the most prestigious Streak in the history of professional sports, the Undertaker's undefeated streak at WrestleMania. Look at that. Look at that. He likes to show off his physique. Look at that. Look at that. If there is an audience to be found for Booger Red, he'll be streaking around half dead, inviting public critique.
of his performance.
This is your Action News reporter once again, and we're here at the gas station. Pardon me, sir, did you see what happened with the Hammerlock and the...
Yeah, I did, Ross, you egg-sucking dog. I was just in here getting my car checked. He just appeared out of traffic, Ross. He comes streaking around the grease rack like my brother Dory. Didn't have nothing on but a smile, you fat son of a bitch. I looked in there and Ethel was getting her a cold drink, you moron. I hollered, "Don't look, Ethel." But it was too late. The egg-sucking dog had already been mooned, flashed her right there in front of the shock absorbers, Ross.
He ain't crude. Look at that, look at that. He ain't lewd. Look at that, look at that. He's just in the mood to run in the nude. Sorry, that's my throat there. Oh, yes, they call him Street. Look at that, look at that. He likes to run and turn, rather, the other cheek. Look at that, look at that. He is always making the news wearing just his Jim Cornette tennis racket shoes. Guess you call him somewhat unique.
And once again, your Action News reporter in the booth at the gym covering the disturbance at the basketball playoff. Pardon me, sir, did you see what happened?
Yeah, I did. Half time, I just going down there to get Ethel a snow cone. And here he come, right out of the cheap seats, dribbling in the middle of the court. Didn't have on nothing but his PFs. Made a hook shot and got out through the concession stand. I hollered up at Ethel, I said, but it was too late. She'd already got a free shot. Grandstanding right there in front of the home team.
Oh, yeah! They call him the Streak. Ended at the hands of Brock Lesnar, the fastest thing on 2 feet. He's just as proud as he can be of his anatomy, which he called the Colonel, by the way. He's going to give us a peek.
Reckon here he come again. Who's that with him? Jesse? Is that you, Jesse? What you think you're doing? What you think you're doing? Get your clothes on.
Oh, yeah, they call him the Streak. The biggest attraction in this industry. And he likes to show off his physique. If there's an audience to be found, he will be streaking around, inviting public critique. Ethel, where are you going? Ethel, you shameless hussy. Say, is it so, Ethel? Ethel!
Our traveling fanboys.